Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 823, and it is September 14th, 1987. I want to begin the program talking about the murder of reggae star Peter Tosh this past weekend. Many of you who have listened to these broadcasts for a long time know that the work I've done on the killing of the rock musicians, starting immediately after Monterey Pop in 1967. In fact, I have enough to do a book that I want to title called Helter Skelter, Gimme Shelter, starting with the Beatles and the expressions that they had in Elvis Presley, the things they were trying to say and seemed to accomplish in their short lifetimes, and then the transfer to the scene at Altamont with the murder of a person on camera. The Hells Angels were brought in as security guards, Melvin Belli, the attorney representing the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels. And after Altamont, that was the end of rock music as it started out or had evolved as some natural form of expression in this country, assisted by LSD sometimes and sometimes not. And the Helter Skelter was used by the Manson family, associated with Vietnam veterans and the intelligence community and the police department in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Sacramento, using the title of the Beatles to associate them with the murders of the Polanski, Roman Polanski's wife, and six other people and his unborn baby at the time of the Manson tragedy. The title of the Beatles song is related to the Manson family. The story this week was another slain, five wounded during robbery. It's always a robbery. The people can take a nickel or turn a pocket inside out. The motive is always money. Three motorcycle gunmen trying to rob reggae star Peter Tosh at his home killed him and another man, wounded five people when they resisted. Tosh, longtime companion Marlene Brown, was among those wounded Friday night at the home of the former Wailer, who was one of the founding fathers of Jamaica's vibrant music of revolution. Outside Jamaica, Tosh, 42, was perhaps best known for his collaboration with the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger, which is interesting after the role that the Rolling Stones played in really entering the informal type of music that was taking place, and they stepped in with this drastic operation, I call it an operation, and yet they were working with Peter Tosh. The article says that he was home. Jamaica's reacted with sorrow and anger at the death of Tosh, who was Marley, and Marley died an untimely early death of violence in his own country in Jamaica, and then cancer treatment by a member of the intelligence German elite over in Germany and sent home to die. An untimely and I would say unnecessary death. Along with Tosh, it was Bob Marley and Neville Livingston. They formed the three-man core of the Wailers. Tosh and Livingston left the band in 1973 as the album Catch a Fire was winning reggae international audience. Tosh formed his own band, Word, Sound, and Power, and wrote songs characterized by their political content. Mama Africa denounced apartheid in South Africa and legalized it, was in favor of legalizing marijuana. And this story just broke September 13th, this past weekend. Now, just a few days before, 2 weeks before, was an article from the New York Times, not over the wire services, so many of you haven't seen it or might not have noticed it. Violent death halts rap musicians' rise. This is August 31st, New York Times. By age 25, Scott LaRock Sterling had achieved what many people only dream of. As part of a duo called Boogie Down Productions, he was on the verge of signing a major recording contract with Warner Brothers Records. Always on the verge, Mama Cass, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, none of them were down, none of them were out. They were all going higher up that ladder. A whole list of about 33 musicians that I have read about and followed and believed had been done in. He was ready with his contract. Their first album, a collection of rhythmic rap tunes on a smaller label, B-Boy Records, was about to hit the record charts. He had kept a promise he made to himself as a young man in South Bronx who became a high school basketball star. He earned a bachelor's degree in business and would settle for nothing less than stardom. This is a person who went on through college and was ready to sign his first large record. Mr. Sterling's rapid ascent was halted early Wednesday when he was shot and killed outside the Highbridge Garden Homes on University Avenue in the South Bronx. According to police and hospital reports, At least one gunman, at least one, three in the case of Tosh, fired from an apartment window across the street at a Jeep occupied by Mr. Sterling and four friends, striking him in the head and neck. His companions, none of them hurt or injured, took him to Lincoln Hospital. There have been no arrests in the case. The police believe, this is in their mind, that Mr. Sterling was caught in a dispute of some kind, wasn't singled out as a target, heavens forbid, a black man with a BA ready to go up the music charts. The other has walked away. It reminded me of the murder of Anwar Sadat with Mubarak and his intelligence chiefs all around him, with a group of gunmen running out of the Jeep and only hitting Sadat. The article says the death of Mr. Sterling, who was known to fans as Scott LaRock, has shaken youth in New York City and around the country who are familiar with his music. Some say the tragedy illustrates how violence and hip-hop music seem to come together like clapping hands at rock concerts and films. And that's by Esther Ibrahim trying to say that pop or rock music seems to suggest violence. It said hip-hop, a blend of recited street poetry, intricate rhythmic beats played and mixed by a disc jockey, which was the role played by Mr. Sterling, started 10 years ago in the Bronx and Harlem. It is popular among people of varying ages and backgrounds, but with his messages about poverty and social ills, it is before all else a music closest to the nation's poor inner city youth. And again, like David Tosh and Bob Marley and the Wailers. In some respects, rap music and violence seem to go hand in hand, said Scott Morris, Sterling's manager, who was in the Jeep when the shooting occurred. But it's not the music itself, it is the environment. Violence was here long before hip-hop, and Mr. Sterling encountered many people with criminal pasts. This is the victim who was killed. It never stopped him from trying to help him inspire others on the streets and through group music. He was described as a big brother, a Pied Piper, a leader, an inspiration to youth. BDP's first hit single, South Bronx, in which the refrain, the South Bronx, the South, South Bronx, is repeated throughout, was in part an effort to instill pride in those who live there, said Mr. Sterling's partner. On the night that he was killed, that Sterling was killed, they went to Highbridge Garden Homes at the request of a 16-year-old former member of his musical group, who's not in the group any longer. He said he was being harassed by older people. By the time this Scott Sterling arrived, there was no harassing or anything happening, and they gathered outside the building to talk. He came there to make peace. He climbed back in the Jeep, and he was gunned down like you hunt an animal. Scott would have come to the help of anyone who called him. That's why he went to help this 16-year-old. He wasn't the type that would ever start trouble. For 2.5 years, Mr. Sterling was a social worker at the Franklin Armory Men's Shelter at 1122 Franklin Street in the Morrisania section of Bronx. Former residents of the shelter remember when he first arrived. Broad-shouldered, young, fresh out of college, 6'2", wearing a tie and carrying a briefcase. He set up group counseling sessions for young homeless men before taking an extended leave of absence to do his musical tour. One of those who was touched by the counseling was a Mr. Parker, a quick-tongued rap artist now known as KRS-One, who became Sterling's partner. On the cover of their first album, Criminal Minded, Mr. Sterling and Mr. Parker are pictured in their trademark warm-up suits, sitting behind desks holding drawn guns. A grenade is on the table. A strip of machine gun ammunition is draped across Parker's shoulder. In the interview, Parker said that he and Sterling were not advocating violence at all, but were explaining that people who are criminal-minded are the people on the top today. Look at the Iran-Contra scandal. And that's what they were trying to convey in their album. Friends described Mr. Sterling as a quiet man. He lived with his fiancée, Dee Demina Brown, and just as Peter Tosh was gunned down with the woman he lives with, this woman was there sharing his success. And when he was gunned down at this time, he was killed in the section of the Bronx. As I say, he grew up in South Ozone Park in the Queens. He graduated from Our Savior High School in North Bronx, where he was a varsity basketball player. He attended Castleton State College in Castleton, Vermont, where he earned a varsity letter. He graduated with a degree in business administration. Malcolm X said in a speech at Harvard, you know what they call a black man at Harvard who has a PhD? They call him a nigger. So here's a young person who goes through college, plays the basketball, gets a degree in business administration, and then gets interested in helping these people in the streets. They said there was a memorial last Thursday at the Latin Quarter of West 48th Street, the main club in Manhattan for rap music. A crowd of 200 sat silently as a series of speakers offered words in Scott Sterling's memory. But perhaps the biggest memorial will come in the weeks and months ahead. The Boogie Down Productions duo had recorded enough music for at least three more albums. That'll be four posthumous albums that he will never see or share. And for at least three, Mr. Parker, his partner, has said. And also at a sold-out concert of rap artists this week, the week of August 31st, at Madison Square Gardens, a moment of silence will be dedicated to him during the time he would have been performing in his biggest show ever. And that is the gunning down of Scott Sterling in New York City on the eve of very big success, having gone to college, done the right things, avoided the violence, avoided the drugs, and if you don't take those, then you can be still removed from the system. And he and the Wailers and Tosh were working on social problems, just two of them dying 2 weeks apart. And another person dying now of inoperable cancer is Billy Carter. Doctors discovered that Billy Carter, the brother Jimmy Carter, has inoperable cancer. The prognosis is poor, and he is going to die. He lives in Georgia. The article from the San Francisco Chronicle said less than two years after joining the lecture circuit, after his brother was out of office, he admitted he was an alcoholic. He entered the Long Beach Naval, this is our government, Naval Medical Center's treatment facility in California for alcohol abuse and exhaustion. Well, it's just a few years since he left that hospital where he was out by 1977, and now he's a dead man. Also, Martha Mitchell was down in that Long Beach area when, at the time of Watergate, when she called Helen Thomas on the telephone and said, "The mafia's in the White House, I know all these people," and she was taken by an attorney, Herbert Kalmbach, to a hospital and got a shot in her behind and died just a few years later of a terrible cancer with symptoms just about identical to AIDS. And Michael Ledeen and Ornard Borchgraf were two of the people working in 1980 using Billy Carter over in Libya, set up by Michelle Papa of the Permandex organization, that group behind the murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, and the sabotage of the 1980 elections not only involved the hostage rescue that involves all the main Iran-Contra characters today, ruining of the hostage rescue of Jimmy Carter, it involved the Billy Gate, it involved the stolen papers off the president's desk involving Edwin Meese and Richard Allen, the national security advisor he was to become in that gang, and Michael Deaver, who was going to other countries, military dictatorships in 1980, getting money for Ronald Reagan's election. There were two or three or four parts of the sabotaging of the election, and one involved Billy Carter. So I think it's very interesting and tragic that he now is dying of an inoperable cancer. And speaking of operations or deaths or goon squads or ways to kill, there are several articles I want to cite that were in the news this week. Not one about a person noted for killing, but one who worked with Robert K. Brown, who was setting up the American Volunteer Group to kill 10,000 people in this country, political ones. So you know how that works overseas if he has hired mercenaries or people that can get rid of rap musicians or Dosh or whatever, or Bob Marley. One of the articles from the Wall Street Journal, Hunt's proposing to sell major portions of two concerns to settle with their lenders. It's a financial article in Wall Street Journal about Lamar Hunt and his family and their business dealings and their financial problems, such as John Connolly is having, and their arrangements drawn up with the First Boston Bank, which has interesting connections to Michele Sindone and Roberta Calvi, and characters I'm going to mention later in Credit Suisse that I've talked about for long, long times. But I do want to tell you that there was an article about the Hunts, and the same day just about that I was reading that, this was September the 8th, and when I was reading it the same day, I came across the articles from the Los Angeles Times about Robert K. Brown, and I mentioned that he was on trial as part of a defense for running a magazine, Soldier of Fortune, that was set up by John Singlaub. And Robert Brown, a colonel, Lieutenant Colonel from the Marines, was the man working with, in Texas, with the Hunt brothers. The talk of setting up these death scenes was described in the book Spooks by Jim Hogan. The title of this article is Gun for Hire Had Many Clients, and I'm not going in, it said they left a trail of death and terror. I'm not going into the whole article now because it's very long, but just to make the point that there are these assassins that are out. The article says that the Soldier of Fortune magazine, and they don't use the name Robert K. Brown, you know, it just runs itself. It doesn't say Sing Robert Brown, settled out of court. They were sued for $4 million in a suit that was settled out of court just recently. I thought we'd see Mr. Brown in court, but no, we don't. And the person who won the suit, this Mr. Norwood, who was supposed to be left for dead, and Kathy Gray, who he married, said that he would not disclose the amount of the settlement, but he said, I don't have to work again if I don't want to. So we'll never see R.K. Brown's face in court. And, of course, he worked with Robert Owen and Ollie North and the whole White House National Security secret team. The L.A. Times just briefly tells about the suit. The part I'll share with you now, it says, Doug Norwood thinks the killers will stalk him again. He walks around with a gun protecting himself, and he's not secure. He said his problems began with a three-line ad in Soldier of Fortune magazine. The ad read, Gun for Hire, 37-year-old professional mercenary desires a job. Vietnam veteran, discreet, very private, bodyguard, courier, and other special skills, all jobs considered. Now, one person, Larry Gray, saw the ad, and he called, and he wanted Doug Norwood killed for dating Gray's ex-wife, Kathy. Besides another person. In this case, they Norwood went to the apartment of not Norwood the killer. Gray sent somebody to answer the ad who went after Doug Norwood. Norwood was a person who was attending college at the time. He didn't have any reason to be suspicious. People wanted him. He was a former Florida prison guard. He was a policeman and a 30-year-old law student at the University of Arkansas. He started going to the law school as a 30-year-old student. And he was working in Arkansas. He lived in an apartment. The doorbell rang. These attackers who answered the ad for Gray that he put in Soldier of Fortune, there were broken ribs and a lot of hurt bodies. And finally, it went back to the ads in Soldier of Fortune run by a Mr. Richard Savage of Knoxville, Tennessee. Another person who was involved with these ads was an Albert Thielman who saw the ad. He called. He wanted his wife, Mary, and their three children killed, and he was willing to blow up an airliner with 154 people aboard to get that job done. Now, remember Franklin Camper, who's now in prison for firebombing a couple of homes in California? He trained the Sikhs that blew up Air India. You think these accidents with absolutely no explanation, such as that Detroit airplane that was on its way to John Wayne Airport, they can't find whether it was the flaps or the engines or the men didn't read the signals. And how do you arrange to blow up a plane to get your own three children and your wife killed? But there was an ad placed, and we don't know what happened to that one. The article says they left a trail of death and terror. Then there was a Robert Spearman who saw the ad, and he wanted his wife, Anita, killed. And the article says the list of potential clients' names was long, and some of the calls were passing strange. A man in Rochester, Minnesota, wanted a chicken shed in Fertile, Iowa, blown up to settle an old score with somebody he didn't like. Mary Alice Wolfe called the number, but the woman she wanted killed in her hometown was spared because she was too pretty to be gunned down. The people didn't want her gunned down. Now, the trail where it went will probably never be fully developed because Robert K. Brown didn't go to trial. They settled out of court, which is very convenient for him. There's another story about Harold Hayes of Rochester, Minnesota, who found an unexploded bomb in his bar and found out that a rival had sent the same gang members to break his kneecaps. He was never lone enough for them to do that. And this article is about people that were sent out to bomb. A family of Albert Thielman was on a flight that landed in Dallas when the bomb went off in the cargo hold, causing a great deal of smoke but no injuries. Mrs. Thielman was even more shocked to find that the bomb had been in her cosmetic case, and one of the members that did this is now in prison. He was indicted for selling Thielman the bomb, and when her luggage left, I guess where you check in to when you arrive, it was put right in her case. And so this whole article is about death, not in Southeast Asia, not in Vietnam, not in El Salvador, not in Costa Rica. This is in the United States of America, And so when these well-known musicians with social messages get wiped out, just take your mind one step further. And based upon so much work I've done on this case, I'm very suspicious, of course. I think they're murders, outright murders are, I don't believe robbery was the story at all. The going price for these people is very big, and there's a lot of money in killing them. As a matter of fact, this past week, I worked several days with somebody who lives not in this country and has written a book on organized crime and elements of it, testified before Judge Kaufman's hearings in 1982 in New York. He's written 6 books. He's a lawyer, and he's writing a book on the murder of one of the musicians. And he came here to get information on the conspiratorial parts, which I don't think he understood what I was saying at all. When the book comes out, I doubt if he will have understood it, because it was very disturbing to him to get really into the depths of who was behind it. When all of that was in the files, he passed it over, and well-intentioned, I'm sure, but not able to handle the hard work. People are in a hurry. They want a quick answer. They want to run off to this country, that country, and look for the person, but they're not willing to sit just quietly and put together a hypothesis that goes from one case to the other, which is unfortunate. I'm willing to meet these people and give it a try, and it's often very discouraging when they leave, because you realize that they hardly understand what you're saying, and you wonder why in the world they're here. And when I asked the question, the answer was that the widow of the person who had been killed through another party told him to see me. So somebody knows something is happening, but the people writing about it still don't let you know what is happening. Now, one thing that is happening in our town that will be over by the time any of you get these tapes, and I'd like to date these programs, so I'll just take the pertinent items this week. The Pope will have come and gone. He's coming to Monterey on Thursday, and he will do a mass out at Laguna Seca and then go to the mission in Carmel. I just want to cite 3 different articles about the Pope. One's from the B'nai B'rith Messenger, and it tells about the Pope coming here, and of course they're concerned. He met some Jews in Italy, and they felt better, and he met the Jews in Miami, and the Jews in Carmel are helping him with all of his businesses, and the Jews in Miami were telling him, you shouldn't have seen Kurt Waldheim, and you should recognize Israel, and the Pope is looking as bored in the photographs as Ronald Reagan was when Elie Wiesel was trying to tell him not to go to Bitburg. They had that mind closed, why are you talking to me, what is this Jew saying, look. And the Jew is saying, why don't you like me? And it's so obvious, if you know body talk, to see what's going on. So the B'nai B'rith Messenger has an article. They said it was learned that following his visit to the United States, Pope Ball has already set a date to meet again with Kurt Waldheim as part of an official visit to Austria. Now, the Pope had Waldheim at the Vatican. Now he's going to Austria, and I'm sure that Helene von Damm and Christian von Damm, her ex-husband, will be over there flying from the Bank of America in Miami to Austria. And so with all the slobbering, you can't keep up with these people unless you get to the root cause of what the problem is. So they're pleading and acting silly, absolutely ridiculous. And now as soon as he gets home, he's off to Austria to have a big laugh with Kurt Waldheim. Another article from the San Francisco Chronicle this weekend, 14 people will lunch with the Pope. I won't run down all 14. I don't even know who half of them are. One is a good friend of my father's, from Los Angeles, Archbishop Roger Mahoney, and I recognize the L.A. names because my father is very close to them in L.A. But one of the interesting people is Archbishop Pio Laghi, L-A-G-H-I, Apostolic Pronuncio to the United States since 1984. I talked about him on World Watchers before. Mr. Laghi is interesting because he was the representative of the Archbishop in Argentina, who gave solace and comfort to the Catholics, part of the P2 operation with Licio Gelli and with the Vatican bankers, Roberta Calvi and Michele Sindona. And he gave comfort to the people who were torturing, the actual torturers of the missing, the people that were found in the ocean, that were dumped in the ocean, the people that were burned outside of the capital in Argentina, where skin was torn off, skin was peeled, limbs were removed, limbs were broken and structured, broken apart. And there were all kinds of tortures. They're still going on, but not as bad. And up to 10,000 to 20,000 people missing. See the movie, The Official Story. There's a lawsuit on that right now that's very interesting. But the story of a woman who had twins and gave them to a family in Paraguay, and then they would take pregnant women and murder them and dispose of their bodies and then use the babies for people who couldn't have babies. So Archbishop Pio Laggi was the gentleman who gave comfort to the torturers. He was the person in residence from the Vatican who gave comfort to the torturers, and now he represents the Vatican in the United States, and he's in Washington, D.C., where he has a lot in common with Ronald Reagan. And also, the L.A. Times had an article, Important Dates in the Life of Pope John Paul II. They begin May 18, 1920, when he was born, and then they go to November 1, 1946, when he was ordained a priest. And they leave out what happened in 1943 and to 1945, and how he worked for I.G. Farben that made the Zyklon B, and he worked not only for Solvay Chemical, which is I.G., but he worked at Auschwitz, which in those days, and on the map, is called Auschwin, but it's the same place, where 10,000 people were killed a day by poison gas, and he was working for the company that made the poison gas. And then he went to Italy and helped the Secretary Montini, who became Pope Paul VI, where they were writing passports for the Nazis to go to Argentina and Chile and Bolivia and Shanghai and all over the world after the war. And then he came back and became a priest. And, of course, the chronology has him in 1946 becoming a priest, but not how he escaped the Russians and worked with the Nazis in his Poland. And this political Auschwitz Pope is very much a part of what has happened during the war and after the war, and he's a symbol to the Polish people of what they didn't finish off and what they would like to do. So just that much. Oh, and the San Francisco Chronicle, September the 8th, has a long article about the Pope and his route, where he'll be in San Francisco. And then there's a section that's called Scandal Fallout. The scandals in which the Vatican became entangled is ugly and even tragic. The circumstances caused widespread repercussions. Aside from having to pay at least $240 million to the creditors of Banco Ambrosiano, a failed Italian bank with which it had become involved, the Vatican's credibility suffered deep damage from its earlier association with Michele Sindona. Sindona died in a jail in Italy with cyanide that he couldn't go out and purchase himself. And John Paul I died in the Vatican before John Paul II was in. That was a 30-day pope, and suggestions he had been poisoned. And also, I'll continue with what the Chronicle said. Sindona, a dapper, gray-haired international financier, made imprudent investments in the Vatican's behalf in the early 70s, and his empire eventually collapsed. Now, they don't have in this article, I'll continue with in a moment, that his client in America, his law office, was Richard Nixon's law office and John Mitchell's. Mitchell, Rose, and Mudge, I believe it is, I forget the name of that last person. There were three names. The law office, he was a client of Richard Nixon's law office in New York City. And he also was co-partner in the banking collapses with David Kennedy, who was Secretary of the Treasury for Richard Nixon and also a high elder in the Mormon Church. But this article, it goes on, when his empire collapsed, it cost the church millions of dollars. Last year, while serving a life sentence in Italian prison for ordering the murder of a lawyer in charge of liquidating the Italian bank, which linked to the Vatican, Sindona, they mentioned, died of cyanide poisoning. It is not known if he was murdered or committed suicide, but Italian politicians believe that Sindona had information that could have embarrassed influential Italians, and I might say Americans too. He had, however, attempted suicide earlier, but they don't say when. As it sought to recover from the Sindona debacle, the Vatican called on Roberta Calvi, a Milan banker known for his workaholic habits and detached personality. And I talked about Calvi last week and Henry Arsan, and I'm going into that part of the White House and the links to the drug traffic and the powers that be in Washington, the arms to Iran, the drugs, and that network. Calvi, a part of that. The Vatican sought their comfort from Calvi, and they refer him as a workaholic. He's a workaholic like Oliver North and Fawn Hall and that gang, who after their 9-to-4 job at the banks or the NSC, then work all night on trying to overthrow countries and kill people. The Chronicle says it turned into a relationship that was even more woeful for Sindona affair, because Calvi used the Vatican standing to help him borrow money in schemes to consolidate his financial empire. I'll take a one-minute break because one half of this broadcast is just about over. Every 30 minutes, we take a one-minute break, and then I'll continue with this and then go on to the complications that are appearing in the newspapers at this time about these very people.